You are now listening to the EU Startups Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the EU Startups Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Dave Senna-Garcia, the news editor here at EU Startups. Today, I chatted with Tyler Edwards. He's the CEO and co-founder of the British cybersecurity startup Overmind. Now, Overmind's interesting in comparison to other companies that we've had on this podcast because it just recently raised its seed round back in February. But the real interesting part and what really brings value to the conversation was Tyler himself and his background in MI5 and MI6 and helping shape national risk intelligence and AI attitudes within government programs. We were able to chat about AI development across Europe, the way China and the US are impacting the innovation sector, specifically AI, as well as the regulation that AI has within Europe. So I hope you're looking forward to that. But before, a quick message from our sponsor, Vanta.
You're a startup founder. Finding product market fit is probably your number one priority, but to land bigger customers, you also need security compliance. And obtaining your SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification can open those big doors, but they take time and energy, pulling you away from building and shipping. That's where Vanta comes in. Vanta is the all-in-one compliance solution, helping startups like yours get audit ready and build a strong security foundation quickly and painlessly. How? Vanta automates the manual security tasks that slow you down, helping you streamline your audit. And the platform connects you with trusted VCSOs to build your program, auditors to get you through audits quickly, and a marketplace for essentials like pen testing. So whether you're closing your first deal or gearing up for growth, Vanta makes compliance easy. Join over 8,000 companies, including many Y Combinator and Techstar startups, who trust Vanta. Simplify compliance and get $1,000 off at vanta.com/EU startups. That's vanta.com/EU startups.
Well, hello, Tyler, and welcome to the EU Startups podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, thank you. As you may know, and as we chatted about just now, we usually don't have that many seed founders on the startup on this podcast to begin with. But that's, I think in this occasion, it merits an exception because I find interesting what Overmind does. I don't think we get that many sort of AI cybersecurity people on here. And you have such an interesting background that I think is worth even just hearing about for anybody that's tuning in right now. So thank you for that. And before we get into any of the questions, I do just want to give you a chance here to present yourself in a better way than I ever could.
Yeah, of course. And yeah, thank you so much for having me on. So yeah, I guess the most interesting bit that offer us is usually my background, at least to start. So I don't come from a typical startup background, especially in the UK. So I started my career in defense and intelligence. So did about 6-7 years with MI5, MI6, GCHQ, which are the three intelligence agencies of the UK, for those that are uninitiated. Came in doing offensive cyber. So this was building a bunch of tools and capabilities, as we refer to them, to all the weird and wonderful things that you can imagine the intelligence agencies do before moving on to a more sort of operational role. And over the time I was there, managed to work in pretty much every large sort of global event of the time. So Afghanistan, Ukraine, and all the other bits. Before, yeah, spinning out to found Overmind, which I assume you can get onto in a moment.
Perfect. Yeah. Well, before we get into Overmind, I think I'm interested to kind of hear about what first you drew into that world, because I know also I've seen from your background, policy advisor in Whitehall as well. So just kind of what pulled you into that? And then separately, what moved you into the startup entrepreneurial world from it?
Yeah, so I'd always been a massive nerd, basically. I'd always wanted to work in tech. And it didn't feel like the pull from the larger companies, say sort of Google, Meta, all the rest, it didn't feel like they were doing things that I necessarily found really interesting. They were building cool products and the tech was obviously impressive, but they weren't solving these sort of like world-changing problems at the time when I was looking to start my career. And British intelligence very much was. They were building tech in these like heavily constrained environments, having to solve unique problems that you just couldn't use like off-the-shelf products for. And that felt really exciting. Plus the work, it sounds pretty sexy from the outside, you know, intelligence and defense and all that stuff. So it was a natural pull. And then the sort of advisory stuff, that kind of ended up happening by accident. So because there wasn't much AI talent in the workforce at the time, obviously much more now, I came in towards the end of my career to just help with some of how sort of MOD and government were looking to integrate what at the time was ML, but eventually AI, integrate that into intelligence analytics and defense. And there's a very short stint of doing the policy advisory stuff because I was more of a technical bod. But that was exciting. It was exciting to see how government and MOD and intelligence, which is famously quite a closed environment, was looking to start sort of onboarding tooling to augment the work they do. But yeah, it was just an incredible place to work. The things that I got to do there, I wouldn't get to do anywhere else, and very much shaped sort of how I am as a founder now, sort of leading this company.
Well, that shaping of how you are as a founder, and without getting to too many specifics, I imagine, you know, there's some limitations to what you can't
say. I don't want to go to jail just yet.
But just, I guess, on a general level, you know, is there a moment you can identify where you're working in these, you know, risk intelligence communities, and you're kind of, you come across something and say, this is interesting, there's a gap here, and maybe I can work to fill it?
Yeah, so as I said, there was, every single thing that you were faced with was often an entirely novel and unique problem. Either the tech solved was, or the specific constraints you were building for were just so hostile that you had to sort of try and find a unique way to solve these problems. Sure. And as we started looking at AI adoption, the same sort of technical challenge came up, in that there was no way government was going to use like an American third-party tool to start doing like internal intelligence analytics and all these sorts of things. And they especially weren't going to use like third-party generic tooling for it. Like, these were use cases that were very specific. The data was very specific. So the process of like building models that were specialized to these use cases, fine-tuning, all that kind of stuff, government just didn't have the infrastructure, again, at the time to do these sorts of things. Saw a very similar thing happening in the commercial space. The trend was just general intelligence. Biggest, baddest API model was what we're referring at most problems. And to me, that just didn't seem like the right way for this new technological trend to be heading. And thus, OverMind was born, basically.
Okay. Well, you know, we're chatting about OverMind. Let's get into OverMind here. And OverMind's interesting too, because I barely understand it. You know, if you're a nerd, and I don't mean that in a bad sense, you know, I'm the other end of being a nerd, which is I don't understand any of this really. Arts and letters were always my thing. But from what I gather, it is an interesting proposal. And you've mentioned here government use of programs. Is that something that OverMind is kind of shooting towards? Because you have that in when we're talking about, you know, you understand how governments and intelligence agencies are using programs. Would you be interested in OverMind eventually evolving towards that kind of use?
Yeah, so I'll tackle both of those. So I guess a real quick summary of what OverMind does. So we are sort of continuous learning is basically what we do. The idea is that people should be moving away from generalized intelligence to models that they own specialized to their data. So we automate the sort of end-to-end process of collecting data, labeling it, training a model specialized on that data, and then shipping it back out again, and then doing that loop again. So the idea is that your agent or your model can just continuously learn from new data and become sort of increasingly specialized to the thing that it's doing. The thing that we always say every time we pitch is that using a frontier model for every agentic task is like using a flamethrower to light a candle. It will get the job done, but it's absolute overkill. You do not need the total sum of human knowledge for the vast majority of what we do with AI. Unless you're doing sort of like quantum physics at the Large Hadron Collider, you don't need a 10 trillion parameter model. So the idea is you can ship sort of smaller, more specialized models. And that does also work with government and defense. Again, these are highly specific use cases, whether it's defense or public health. Being able to train and hone your model to the specific sort of demographic or use case that you're deploying it for, it's far more performative. The model will just be better. It will be faster. It'll be safer than just this general API model with a system prompt. That's never going to be a very robust technical setup. So for us, it's about what's next. AI has been exciting over these last years and a year and a bit, but what's next? And for us, it's owning that stack and specializing intelligence rather than just having these general models.
Okay. Well, what's ground this for me a little bit, because I think I can't be the only one who kind of hears AI risk and just think, okay, what does that mean? I mean, you know, is my ChatGPT going to hallucinate more? You know, can you give me kind of a grounded example of what AI risk could mean and the danger that you see there?
Yeah, so I think when we talk about AI risk, I think that there's sort of two counts. There's the kind of like catastrophic risk of AI is going to be used to develop bioweapons, for example. And then there's the other side of it, of AI hallucinating, just not doing the things we want, not being very performative. And it's that side that we sit. We're not on the sort of catastrophic risk side. I guess the simplest way to put it is AI models are probabilistic in that they are having a general guess at what it is you've asked them to do. And if you want sort of a higher occurrence of the correct guess, you just need to index that a little bit more. It's kind of like having a bowl of Tic Tacs, for example, and I say there's 100 in this bowl, 10 of them are poison pills. If I want to reduce the occurrence of poison pills, I just need to sort of train them out. So take a few routes, swap those over Tic Tacs. Loosely, that's how the fine tuning works. We are increasing the probability that the output from the model is within that area of speciality that you want. And I guess the thing with general big models is they know everything. They know as much about Shakespeare as they know about melanomas and as they know about a recipe for a Victoria sponge. So this is sort of probabilistic outcomes that you just don't want in your model. If the thing that you're doing, for example, is KYC for a bank, train your model to do that thing really, really well with a bit of specialization inside, and your model is just going to perform much better because that is the knowledge that it's focused on. Skipping out a few technical pieces for the sake of time, but that's the general gist.
Okay. Yeah, it's because I think a lot of people, when they hear cybersecurity, startup focusing on cybersecurity, even AI cybersecurity, you know, your mind immediately goes to deepfakes or AI attacks or, you know, phishing for your credit card information, that kind of thing. So it's interesting to kind of get a little bit of an insight here into a different angle and a different kind of outlook as to the way we're progressing with this kind of AI technology. When you raised your seed round, which is how I originally heard about you, we got your press release. It was in February. Yes, February this year, that you raised 2.3, I think we had euros. So that in it, there was this stat that kind of jumped out to me. And it was that it was a Gartner study that was said 40% of agentic AI projects could be canceled due to inadequate risk controls. So I want to hear a little bit about that. Not that specific figures. I know it's not yours, but what would you say is kind of driving the issue to begin with?
Yeah, I guess there's two things in that. When we started the company, we were far more focused on this idea of AI security, and we've kind of vacated that space a bit because for us, when we were talking to customers about security, it was a proxy word for performance. They just wanted to build something that did all the things they promised it could do. They were kind of willing to take some of the risk with AI in terms of like third-party data access and all the rest, as long as it made them competitive and compelling and they weren't left behind, and the thing that they were building was performative. And largely the reason we're seeing a lot of these agentic products being canned is because they're just not reaching any of these benchmarks and thresholds. The models aren't performing the way that the teams want them to. They're proving to be sort of very cumbersome to maintain and to develop. Technical teams are having to all of a sudden onboard either new staff or new skill sets to sort of control this unwieldy technology. So for the most part, people are just defaulting either to verticalized tools. They'll just buy something external or just use traditional software, use something that's more deterministic. I think we're kind of coming down the other side of the curve where we were kind of throwing AI at everything. And now we're kind of realizing that, like as powerful as the technology it is, we don't need to put AI in absolutely everything. Learning still, it's just, Well, we had exactly the same thing with Bluetooth, right? All of a sudden, Bluetooth is really exciting and popular. IoT is really popular and you can start tweeting from your fridge. How many people can still tweet from their fridge? I think we realized that it was not something that people needed and it wasn't solving a problem. I think we're doing the same with AI. Everything had AI for a period of time, and we're kind of coming down to the side a bit where just putting AI in something is not enough. We're also trying to work out, like, do we actually need AI here? Math still exists. ML still exists. Deterministic software still exists. Where can we use AI where it's actually going to be a force multiplier? So I think the risk for a lot of teams is investing all of this capital and time in building something that in the end
was just a complicated piece of tech that isn't actually providing any additional company benefit. At least that's the area of risk that we come from. There are obviously other things relating to data loss prevention and all the rest that people are focused on. I have my own opinions on that when it comes to AI. But for us, it's about how do we help teams utilize this incredibly powerful technology in a way that is enduring and doesn't just mean they're going to spend cash and time in something they end up throwing in the bin.
Well, that's why I love these conversations, because it kind of makes me feel less like a Neanderthal, because I actually kind of understand what you're talking about. I think this is great. I can follow this conversation. Sometimes we'll get a press release and I'll read it and it'll just be gibberish to me. I'll say, I don't know what any of this means. And that's difficult as a journalist, because you're expected to push these things out there. And then you're kind of left thinking, I feel like I need a master's degree to understand what you're talking about. So,
well, this is the thing, right? In that, This is such a transformative technology that right now is not as accessible as it should be, especially on the granular level. Right now, if you decided you wanted to train a model for yourself on your own data, how would you go about that? You'd have to learn Python. You'd have to get a PhD to learn Tinker and things like that. It's about what can we build to bring that bar incredibly low so that teams can do these things. They can control the technology that's about to define the next few decades of how companies grow and build and all the rest. And that's very much our mission statement. There's no safe world where this technology is owned just by OpenAI and Anthropic. Like, it needs to be something that is readily accessible and buildable by everybody.
Well, I think that kind of leads us to a natural topic. And this is moving a little bit away from over mine, but you are just kind of already touching on, is this tension over AI sovereignty? Because there's different European approaches, and there's the foreign players, OpenAI, DeepSeek, what have you. How do you see that playing out over the next couple of years? There's so much, because you've got the kind of understanding at a policy level, but you also got the technical understanding. What kind of just the outlook that you see moving forward?
Yeah, I think we're seeing a real resurgence of open source in these last year and a bit. I think GTC, so the team was in San Francisco for a bit. We went to GTC, which is NVIDIA's sort of big tech conference. And so much of the conversation there was about open weights models. These are models that are sort of open source. You can sort of see the internal workings. And I think that is where the market is starting to move. And I think that is sort of the natural market pull. I think people want technology that they can control, technology they can deploy onto their own sort of infrastructure and all the rest. There's now this massive drive for sovereignty, especially in the UK and Europe, to own the tech that is being integrated into, again, like public health services as well as as the open market. So having an entire dependency on like one or two US companies it's not a particularly robust approach to things. I think naturally it's like the tech ecosystem that's pulling us there. I think there are now 13 million models that you can download across the ecosystem. It's absolutely ridiculous. Some of them are really, really big in general. Some of them are incredibly specialized and niche. But it's this these natural market forces when it comes to tech that are coming to play here. And open source has always been where the innovation really happens. I mean, famously, OpenAI started as an open source company before they pulled that ladder up really, really quickly. So I think that's where we're heading back to is the return of open source. And that's very much something that we're trying to push as well. The power of our product is you can just pick an open weights model and train it however you want and then deploy it wherever you want. And it is yours. It's yours to do with as you wish. So eventually working with sort of government and defense on this AI sovereignty piece would be interesting. Though, again, I have my own opinions on startups working with government, especially in the UK, but maybe that's a conversation for another time.
Sure. Yeah. No, and we do want to keep in mind here, it is for entrepreneurs. We're not trying to get too political over this chat, as interesting as it may be. Having said that, and I am going to slightly go into those waters, I'm curious to hear about your idea over AI regulation when it comes to Europe, because that's a big topic. That I talked to the law entrepreneurs, is the regulation, and we're talking umbrella term regulation, right, for any sector. There's the continuous complaint that Europe puts too much regulation on innovation. And we're talking about AI. You've just made the argument that is one of the most important kind of advancements we've had. So how do you see kind of European regulate? We've got the AI Act, things like that. Where do you stand on it?
Yeah, where do I stand on it? I think there's certainly an onus to ensure that the public good is always preserved, regardless of what the technology is. I think that is paramount.
there's also this other like conflicting pulling force of allowing the market to do its thing and allow this technology to accelerate. We will be left behind if we don't. It's a difficult balancing act. I think the problem with regulations like the EU AI Act is they're half-assed in that if you're a lawyer worth your money, you can kind of circumnavigate it. So if you're going to place regulations into play, then they need to be sort of definitive and focused enough that they do protect public good. They're there and designed to still allow innovation and market growth with protection of the individual and the state and all the rest, not just like an annoying piece of bureaucracy that you just need to take a bit of time sort of getting around to carry on. I think a lot of the conversations I think are most interesting are things sort of like ownership of self. Like if someone clones your voice on 11 Labs, do you own your voice? Is that your data? Sort of things that people put on the open internet that's now being used to train models people have to pay for, but is right. Free data on the internet. Those are places where I think individual isolated regulation makes sense. One big overarching regulation for AI, it's too watery, it's too broad. It's kind of like saying we're going to regulate science. It's like, okay, which bit? Biology, like neuro, like which bit? I think the isolated regulations that are more scoped and specific have often made more sense. And I think we've seen various examples of that, again, using my IoT cloud, all other sort of previous technical advances that have happened that have taken similar trends. It's happened in the same way. You start with this like overarching idea for regulations and laws, and then usually that's shattered into smaller pieces because we see that this overarching piece doesn't capture all of the nuance of different parts of the sector. I'm not a lawyer, so take everything I say with your recommended daily amount of salt. But that's my thinking. I think always, you know, as someone that comes from the world of government and public good, as it were, I think we shouldn't just have this dystopian world where the technocrats can do as they wish for the sake of profit. But we need to be realistic. And if, for example, we see that maybe players and nation states that are going to use AI in ways that aren't as wholesome as we might expect in the West, if we decide to hinder how we develop the technology, then we will just be left behind. So there's always going to be these, balancing forces, I would say, which is, that's one of the most political and diplomatic answer you've ever heard to that question.
Well, but, I expected nothing less. It was just in line. It's good that these conversations are happening. I mean, not just between you and me, but really, you know, with anybody that's innovating in Europe right now, they have it in their mind as to how AI is going to impact what they're doing, how regulation is going to impact what AI is doing to their sector. So it's if anything, I think it's a positive that we're all having these conversations really so early on, and that we're not kind of waiting to see what's going to happen. We're trying to take, you know, grab the bull by the horns. But with that in mind, I'm curious to hear if, because now you've entered the entrepreneurial world, and I'm sure you have a more contact now, and you're speaking with more founders such as yourself. Have you seen there to be a difference the way they approach AI and AI safety from when you worked MI6, MI5, when you were at Whitehall? Is there a difference kind of between the government approach to AI and AI risk versus the entrepreneurial approach to AI and AI risk?
Oh, yeah, 100%. There was this really old meme that used to go around of like, if there was like a big internet trend, like 10 years later, someone would put like an internet explorer has finally caught on to this trend. That is very much government. Government is as much as I love them, very, very slow when it comes to tech adoption. Obviously so, like, you know, the UK government is this behemoth of an organization. It does many things. So also trying to keep on top of what new technical trends are going on is a struggle. Whereas in the entrepreneurial world, in startups and the open market, it's so fast. People are constantly on top of what's new, what's happening, especially when it comes to AI. Everyone is so engaged and excited. I think the open market has utterly eclipsed what sort of is happening at the government level, especially in different ecosystems. I think, you know, famously SF in the US, it's very rapid, it's very fast. But I think especially in the UK and in the EU, there is still this like really rapid speed of growth when it comes to startups and in AI and tech, but government is slow. The UK has just spun up like a sovereign AI fund. I think it's sort of 500 mil size fund, which is a good step. It's sort of forward. It'd be interesting to see how the capital is deployed and sort of what the focus will be. Is it going to be infrastructure? Is it going to be application layer SATs? These sorts of things. But yeah, I think the time you spent in SF, the time you spent in New York, seeing the way that people were just going crazy with AI was absolutely incredible.
Okay. Well, and you're building over mind now in time, as we've said, where everything's just, there's more and more companies, more and more different focuses on AI infrastructure, cybersecurity, you know, even if we sector by sector, there's AI for legal tech, AI for agri-tech, you know, AI for everything. So how do you see Overmind standing among this competition? Now, just quick figure, I had a quick look over our coverage. And just in the past year, when we're talking about AI security, infrastructure, innovation and funding, we saw around 75 million euros. And that's per our coverage. So how do you see Overmind standing in this area and kind of distinguishing itself?
Yeah, so I guess one of the key things we never, well, used to, but now never really describe ourselves as a security company. We're definitely in the infrastructure world. It's about being this sort of ubiquitous layer that enables a lot of powerful things on top. So if, for example, as you said, like agriculture, health tech, whatever it is, if these teams decide that, hey, what I want to do is build technology that is bespoke to the industry I'm working in or my very specific use case. Maybe, for example, OpenAI says, you know what we're going to do? We're going to build an agriculture LLM. Here you go. Here's a model focused on LLMs. Does it know anything about the fertility of soil in Tuscany? Probably not, because it's a general model. So maybe you want to train something on that specific data, and that's where we would come in. We allow teams to take what is this general intelligence and power it to them. Right now, people love just to say, we are doing AI for X. It's becoming less and less interesting to say that you're doing AI for X because it is so ubiquitous. Everyone is doing AI for something. It's kind of like saying your website is on the internet. It's like, well, of course it is, because it is. Like it's now the floor to be using AI. So the next step on top of that is, okay, well, if you and 1,000 of your competitors are just these general AI products that are making an API call to the newest Claude model, how are you differentiating? What are you doing that is technically exciting, that is more powerful than all the other teams standing next to you? And the trend that we're seeing at the moment is proprietary models, models that are trained on data from whatever corporate you're working in. And the Intercon team, their Fin product, they recently released a fine-tuned model. And now their like main competitive edge is one of the only, if not the only, company within the sector that has like a proprietary model trained on data that they've shipped into the market. So that is what we're enabling. We're enabling teams to do this very, very quickly. Rather than taking weeks and months, it takes hours for them to train a model that they can then put out into the market.
Okay. Well, and this next question is maybe a bit premature, you know, considering you're at seed, but I think it's interesting. And I always wanted to ask it to founders who come from another world than the entrepreneur world, because, you know, you really have founders divided into those two camps. Ones that come from kind of a real world application, bring it into a new company, or ones that just go straight into building a new company. Both are successful. Some are successful, some are not. It's not up to me to decide which, but I do want to kind of hear about if there was any difficulty on your end in making that pass over, because I think that's something that gets overlooked sometimes, and that you have to change your mindset and you have to change an attitude from being an employee, government employee, to then moving into, I'm going to lead my own company. Was there any kind of bumps in the road so far, or challenges that you can kind of put forward?
Yeah, I think anyone that does this, regardless of where you come from, there's going to be huge challenges. Even if you're going from, you know, like a really empowered role at like a big tech company, stepping into this, all of a sudden there are like 1,000 things you need to constantly be on top of. I think for me, I guess I was kind of lucky in some regards in that I'd come from a very unique environment where there was just like 1,000 things each day that you just had to be so cognizant of. And especially on like the technical sides, you were just having to find new ways to solve entirely unique problems every single day. And there weren't really many people that could help you. Like you had a team around you, but you kind of had to sort of work this out on your own, which is very much the same as this. You're doing something that is gargantuan. Like the idea of trying to found a company, if you're doing VC, the idea of that company being worth hundreds of millions, if not billions, is not a small endeavor. So stepping into that, you're going to have a whole range of problems that come your way. And for me, I think the whenever there has been a bump in the road, be it, you know, where do we move the product? How do we hire HR, visas, all the rest? The best thing is just to surround yourself with people that have run this gauntlet before or can just sort of be in your corner when you need them. We have a great advisory team. We've hired really well. Our investors are brilliant. Like, there are people now I can fall back to and say, look, I don't know how to answer this question quickly. Can you help me answer this question quickly? And that is fine. That is absolutely fine. I think the public profiles of founders that you're sort of told to put forward is one of sort of this indomitable person that just knows everything. Like, there's never been a problem I can't solve. It's not true. It doesn't matter who they are. It's absolutely not true. They are surrounded by people that are helping them. At the end of the day, you are just one person. So surround yourself with people that can help you win. That was a generic answer, but say, yeah, there are, of course, there are a range of problems.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then is my final question, and I'll let you go. But it's important, I think, at the end of all of these interviews, to ask about where you see your company going in the future or what kind of goals you have for it. I mean, you've already mentioned that you evolved from AI security into more infrastructure. So do you see another evolution coming down the pipeline? Where do you want to see Overmind 5 years from now?
Yeah, I think this sort of the pivot from security into this has been like the most validating thing. I think all of a sudden the company's growing in ways that we couldn't really imagine. The open source product is growing really well. The enterprise stuff is growing really well. So now we are sort of locked on to Series A first half of next year. We're going to be expanding into the US over this year as well, and also the rest of the EU. So really, it's how big can you go is always the question. And for us, we'll see. Like it's as large as we can. But yeah, at the moment, the core focus is approaching Series A. So making sure that the enterprise adoption is really strong, the partners that we're working with at the moment stick, and we build something compelling for them. Because we're an open source product, obviously building the sort of community and ecosystem we have there is really important. So we're running a bunch of hackathons, events, all these sorts of things over the coming year. And we finished hiring now. The team has grown nicely. So it's heads down and running straight on to Series A.
Okay. Well, we hope to hear from you. I'll keep my mailbox open. I'm sure I'll probably be able to understand it more if this is for the Series A, that's for sure. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Tyler. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
All right. And hopefully we'll keep in touch.
Yep. Fair enough. So see you later.